life cycle of a grant. The intent is really to cover cradle to grave so that we have a really good understanding of how things start all the way through how things finish. We're not going to go into agency-specific details. The intent is really to give an overview of what we can expect when we're dealing with grants. We are not covering contracts. We are not covering CFI awards. Those will be covered in the following 2 month sessions. So this is really grant specific, and we will cover the difference between a grant and a contract later on. Introduction, it's done, life cycle. I guess I will now introduce Olga Neyberger, who is the Associate Director of Grants and Foundation, who will start the presentation for us. Enjoy it.
Guys, good morning. My name is Olga Neyberger. I'm from Office of Sponsored Research, and I represent the team named Grants and Foundations. So our team, it's really the team that researchers, administrators have the first contact in this cycle of grants administration. So as you see on the screen, we start all the time, this cycle start with, from proposal development. This, we try to present like some big component then involved the different step in proposal development. So it's not just one step, it's really a continuity of certain activities. So the first, what researchers start, it's really idea. They start to think and about their what they would like have objectives for the long term, for the short term. So they really researched, they specialized in certain area of research, and certainly they have idea, and they eager to learn something new and to develop and move research further. After this, the next step would be certainly to translate those research ideas in reality, okay? What would be exactly expected outcomes? What would be activity needs to be undertaken to achieve the objectives of certain research? And certainly in this time, they start to think about resources required for this. It's in the sense of what complementary expertise they need, what partners they need to conduct specific research, as well in the terms of funding, what would be their cost of the future research activities. So after this, certainly the next step would be again moving to concrete reality. They should distinguish the really the most important components of their research, which certainly need to be done the first and carry out specific activities. When they contact us, we told them, okay, please, when you're looking for the funding opportunities, be really strategically look in the different type of funding. Don't be stuck with regular agency, because some agency funded only specific type of research or specific activities. Certainly, this is really a lot of research for funding, even where you as administrator could really help also to the researchers. So to be creative in looking in funding opportunities. What our team we are doing? We are trying to help you or and researchers to locate funding opportunities. You could see this is our OSR website. So I invite you really to visit our website if you didn't do this yet. So here you could find the description on some funding opportunities or specific granting agency, federal, international, foundations funding. I think you know and you see that we distribute through listserv funding opportunities from our team. I know I heard the different feedback. Some people very happy to get them. Some people telling, okay, it's bombarding. But I think the major part of, after our review, the major part of the people are really happy because this funding opportunity that we sent through ListServe, it's already pre-screened by our grants officers in the terms of eligibility for us as institution to apply, for eligibility of our professors to apply. As well, we indicate more specific external details that they have to pay attention from the beginning, as well our internal process, so you could see contact person, you could see deadline, it's what required to be done on pre-award stage. As well, here you could find a link to external database as a community of science, funding opportunity database, US agency database. Here it's really up to you to play and try to find additional complementary funding. But as I mentioned before, please be creative. Look really on the different type of agency which might fund research in the same specific area where your researcher is looking for. As well, here you could find all the time a summary of our OSR deadline list summarized per month, the different call for proposals, as well external agency deadline, as well our internal deadline for submit proposal. So the next step, it would be really plan and draft research applications. Like you see, it's indicated, please, researchers, administrator, starts as early as possible and contact us as early as possible. So when you look in the funding opportunity, so you try to figure out, as I mentioned, to align the future research activities with mandate of sponsor. It could be granting agency, it could be a financial institution, it could be foundation. So you, and sometimes it's not easy to navigate. So this is what I invite you, please contact grants officers as early as possible. They're really to help you, to help researchers, because they have already expertise. They have experience in the different call for proposals. So even to collect institutional intelligence from the previous calls, from the previous rounds, they could really to help to identify and provide advice, expert advice. Also, please pay attention if researcher submitted application from affiliated hospitals, they should go and submit through their research office. But again, please pay attention, not all the granting agents, not all sponsors accept application through the hospitals. A simple example, CIHR certainly consider hospitals as eligible institution when NSERC not allowed, they not look at them as eligible institutions. So in this case, applications must go through our Office of Sponsored Research from through McGill University. And please make list what's exactly at this stage should be done. As, for example, if research and usually required partners, supporting organization, please look on CV of the, your or researchers' partners. Look on the start to collect a letter of support. Start. We have to start to negotiate maybe the terms of the future support as early as possible, so we'll not be really running at the last minute before agency deadline. So when a researcher prepare a draft, so what really, what type of internal review and approval must be done through our team, through our Office of Sponsored Research? Because we are our team responsible for pre-award process at McGill, at McGill for grant applications. As I mentioned already, we provide expert advice on funding opportunities, on specific requirements aligned with a granting agency, as well as McGill internal policy and procedure, which have to be respected in each particular proposal, in each particular future project. As well, we organize on a regular basis info sessions Usually it's like more often it's coming the researchers. Info sessions are really grantsmanships on the certain granting agency on specific call for proposals. Please, administrators, you are welcome also to attend these sessions because here you could learn more specific on particular call on particular agency. And usually we invite people from hold the previous awards from this agency, or our grants officers will present you very useful tips. As I mentioned also, we communicate funding opportunities and as well results of the competitions when it's finalized. And we certainly the first contact for you and for researchers on pre-award process. What exactly, I mean, it's a lot of the details, but I would like to just mention a few of them that it's really fundamental, basic, what we're looking when a review proposal before submissions to granting agency. Certainly we look in eligibility based on sponsor regulations, so it doesn't make sense to submit proposal if sponsor not accept our organizations as eligible, not accept our researchers as eligible because of specific appointments. They might not fund this specific area of research. Also, we look on in proposal, looking for the clarity of language and presentation. So this, when it's provided on early stage, grants officer have chance to give feedback, so really to provide add value support, so proposal might be improved and to increase chances for success. Because they could suggest how better to align objectives of the funding opportunities with in proposal. As well, we're looking on budget request and justifications, and here exclude not only budget that you request from this particular agency. Such specific calls might require matching contributions, so this is where could we provide you advice and help you to make sure that eligible expenses included, that make sure that you didn't forget to include some expenses that would be very important when you run projects. For example, sometimes salary included, but you or researcher might forget to include benefits component, or they might include forget to include indirect costs. But for the budget, how to provide, develop optimal budget, it would be this specific session, I think next month or a couple months later, where we could look into this in more details. So what kind of resources our grants officers using to provide this type of support on the pre-award stage? Certainly funding opportunities guidelines. They specialized in certain area of granting agency, and I mean, it's not like really a limited list. If you see, they have the list of granting agency, 3-4 pages, so more than 100 agency, each of them. So they have the copy of the previous reviewers, and as mentioned, they collect already institutional intelligence, so they could really to give a very good advice based on the previous lesson learned and knowledge of the particular agency and particular call for proposal. They also looking in confirmation of matching in-kind contributions, because don't forget, no applications would be submitted and signed on behalf of McGill if we don't have proof that required matching contributions or contributions from the partners confirmed and signed by official representative, as well as contribution from department and faculty should be approved and signed by chair and deans of the faculty. This is OSR checklist. So I guess all of you saw already this document. Just mentioned that now we're really under constructions and we're planning to really to launch the new revised checklist somewhere in October, and we have session also on this just to really to align with the more recent requirements of the granting agency and McGill internal policies and procedure. This document, it's a really tool among researcher, department, faculty, and Office of Sponsored Research. For faculty and department, it helps to assess and confirm support to the project, including budget and available resources. So Associate Dean's Research Chair, they're looking there. They, by their signature, they approve that they allowed to use, for example, lab space for this particular project, or they allowed additional time for researchers to spend on the project. And the different any type of support that we could see should be confirmed by a signature on OSR checklist. For us, it's also to helping really to, in summary of the different component, to verify eligibility, to verify and to flag the future need for compliances such as ethics approval, animal approvals, biohazards, conflict of interest, and et cetera. I could go on, and it's a lot of different type of requirement. As well, we use this tool to collect data for future reporting or for current reporting, because certainly lesson learned and the previous experience very important for today and for future. So what about institutional endorsement in submission? Here I would like to bring to your attention, please, make sure and understand, according to McGill Signing Authority regulations, only special delegate people at the Office of Sponsored Research have right to sign application on behalf of McGill University. No chair, no dean, no any administrator from the faculty, not researchers himself doesn't have authority to commit institution for the future project, for future application. Also, we are asking, please provide any help, support to researchers trying to submit the OSR checklist and draft applications as early as possible, so it's more chances for us to work with you, to work with researchers, to really align and to give better chances for specific applications. Grants officers also like mentioned that if submissions sometimes going directly to granting agency as a hard copy, but more and more granting agency in electronic submission system, so our granting office, grants officer have authority on behalf of McGill push button, and this is really assigning their authority to commit university for future project. This is just summarize fundamentals of pre-award. Certainly, please respect internal deadlines. Internal deadlines usually 5-10 working days before agency or sponsor deadlines. It again depends on the complexity of future application. And again, please try to submit as early as possible so we have really chance to review your proposal. For example, on March 1st, we have a deadline for CIHR operating grants, and we have internal deadlines asking to submit proposal by February 20. We have registered a list on 158 notice of intent to submit proposal. So you could imagine that with this volume, we certainly would be more happy to give and to provide more substantial feedback if you submit to us or researchers send to us applications today. Okay, so we have like 30 days, or no, not 30 days, it's already not 30 days, a couple weeks, but certainly pay attention to this. As well, OSR checklist, it's our tool and it's required on all applications for grants and contracts and agreements. It's required even in the cases when official signature for an application is not required, but it's required internally to make sure that chair, dean, endorsed participation in the project. They really endorse using of faculties, departmental resources for the future research. And certainly signature, as I mentioned, please, this must be reviewed by grants officers and it must be signed by authorized McGill representative. Usually it's me, It depends of the level of application. So, but certainly everything done in Office of Sponsored Research, even application which, for example, with a request for 10 million, it should be signed by Vice Principal Research, but it's again, she will sign only after our approval, our review and recommendations for her to sign. Okay, so next step, it's really when submit application, it's going to the peer review at the agency. Certainly, peer review, we will have this specific session also on peer review process, but it's just, again, grosso modo, really agency contact eligibility screening. They send to peer reviewers. They invite usually researchers in the same with a particular area of expertise from Canada or internationally. And after comments and recommendations from a reviewer sponsor will make a decision which proposal would be funded. So as soon as we learn about results, we are communicating these results to researchers. In this stage, we're also doing certainly some background work at our office. We logging all the proposals, all documents on our internal database InfoEd system, which used now broadly by Office of Sponsored Research to communicate information to financial services, as well deans and faculties, they have access to certain information. As well, at this stage also, it might be additional requirement from a granting agency. Sometimes they would like to confirm eligibility. They would ask us to provide additional documents from organizations, so we're doing this. If you really eager to learn about peer review process right now, not wait to our special session. So this is some resources that are available for you. You could really come to our sessions. As I mentioned, you could look in the manuals on website. You could look in program guidelines, what it's exactly criteria used by selection committee, used by peer review. It's certainly on the content of research, as well on the project management, as well on the budget and resources committed. So, as soon as results announced, everybody happy, I mean, who succeeded. So these results we are giving from our team, we are passing this successful awarded proposal to our awards management team in the Office of Sponsored Research. But certainly the biggest part of application is not funded. So what is for us, it's lesson learned, it's expertise, it's our experience that we will use in future really to help our researchers to succeed next time. So this is now I'm passing to our next team, awards management team, which will work with awarded projects, and this will be your next contact team. Thank you. If anybody have questions? Okay, it's clear. Or at the end.
Okay, I was going to use the lapel, but I'll just stand here. For those that were lucky enough to get some funding, indeed the file now comes to the awards management team. And I know that this is where a lot of people sometimes get confused because you're used to dealing with grants and foundations and then you deal with RFMS, but then we're kind of like in the middle and it's like, well, who are these people? So we're going to try and clarify exactly what awards management team does. So I'll just go ahead and do this. Okay. So what exactly do we do? We get the notice of awards, we get grant agreements. Some agencies will require us to enter into grant agreements. Okay, I'll stand here. Some agencies will actually give us grant agreements that have specific clauses and all that. So we review the notice of awards, we review the grant agreements. We negotiate the grant agreements when needed if some of the terms are not acceptable or they need clarification. And then we actually accept the awards on behalf of McGill University and Office of Sponsored Research and the PIs. We delineate award parameters and terms and conditions. I'm going to go in more into detail in the next couple of slides. We approve new fund creation, go over that too. We assist with a lot of the post-award management, so any changes to the award that we need to communicate to sponsors, issuance of sub-awards, and we liaise with sponsors, PIs, you, and RFMS. So I like to say that we kind of have a leg in OSR, and we also have somewhat of a leg into RFMS. We're kind of like the middle, where we connect PIs in OSR and RFMS. So in a nutshell, this kind of summarizes what we do. I'm not going to go over in detail, so this is a resource material for you to have and go back to. And again, I'm going to go into a lot more detail. So what exactly do we do when we actually approve an award? So the first thing we do is we need to identify what type of award it is. I'll explain that. Then we delineate terms and conditions. There's other conditions that also can apply to awards that we have to figure out and identify what those are. Then we actually approve the award, and that goes to RFMS for fund creation. So those are really the five steps that we go through with an awarded project. So type of award, I think it's sometimes difficult to know what is a grant, what is a contract. Again, as I mentioned earlier, we're not going to go into details with contracts. There really will be a specific session. But just so that you have an idea of what a grant is versus what a contract is. So a grant generally goes through a peer review process versus a research agreement with an industry sponsor or a specific contract that we actually did a bid proposal on. Those rarely go through peer review. Not that they never do, but they rarely do. Versus grants, they pretty much always go through a peer review process. They're competing for funding with their peers. The scope of work on grants is developed by the PI. It's defined by the PI, and the PI usually really has full liberty in terms of the direction of the research. Versus a contract, the scope of work usually is going to be agreed upon by the PI as well as the sponsor. Or in the case of an actual true bid competition where we are bidding or a clinical trial or a service, it really is the sponsor that is dictating the scope of work. We are doing something that they want us to do on those type of agreements. Deliverables on grant are usually reporting, financial reports and progress reports. There might also be a couple of other little reports here and there. But on average, that's what it is versus contracts. You often will have specific deliverables, specific milestones. You have to meet those milestones. You have to meet those timelines. Grant will also have usually detailed budgets that are required per sponsor, specific requirements, eligibility of expenses, those kind of things. The sponsors will also dictate usually if indirects are allowed or not. They also will often put limits on the indirects that we can assess on grants versus contracts. Oftentimes the budgets are fixed price, meaning that we get paid once we've reached the milestones or the deliverables. Some can be claim-based, which means that we submit invoices as we incur the costs. But usually the budgets are flexible. If there is a detailed budget included in contracts, they're usually flexible versus grants, not always. And on contracts, usually indirects are per institutional rates established. Sponsors can dictate rates on contracts, but usually it's institutional rates that apply. Grants, unrestricted rights to publish. We very rarely have to submit our publication to the sponsor for prior review of that publication. PIs usually can publish without any restriction as long as they acknowledge support of the publication. And there usually is no restriction on IP, so if there is an intellectual property that we develop, we keep ownership of that IP. Versus on contracts, oftentimes there will be prior review, not approval. We never accept approval, and we'll, again, go over that in the contract session. But there is often a prior review period on publications, and usually terms of IP, confidentiality, indemnification, those clauses are negotiated by the contracts team on contracts. So in a nutshell, grants, contracts, and again, we're dealing with grants only today. So a grant is a grant, but it's not all that easy. Then we often have to then figure out, okay, well, what type of grant is this? So we can get a notice of award, which is pretty easy. It's a couple of pages or one pager that delineates start date, end date, amount awarded, usually very straightforward to understand. Our Tri-Council, our notice of awards, NIH our notice of awards, so they vary our somewhat standard. But then we also have letters of acceptance, which is not a it's a notice of award, but it also has a lot more terms and conditions. A notice of award will also usually refer us to existing policies, like Tri-Council policies. So the notice of award doesn't break down every term and conditions because it refers back to policies that we should be familiar with. Versus a letter of acceptance is usually going to include more specific terms and conditions, but they're not really negotiable. You either accept them or you don't. And usually McGill is the only one that signs on those type of letters of acceptance. We also get grant agreements or contribution agreements. Those ones are the ones that we sometimes end up having to negotiate or clarify terms. We both agree to terms and conditions, and usually both signatures are required from both entities, from the sponsor as well as McGill. And sub-agreements are a big, big chunk of what we get, in which we are co-applicants or co-investigators on applications, but we're not the lead institution, which means that the other institutions have to sub-award to us so that we get the money in the door and we conduct the scope of work that we are supposed to be doing and that we're put in the project to do. So sub-agreements basically authorizes us to for a specific scope of work and authorizes us to open a fund and commit to, there's a commitment between the two institutions to make us work together. So going back, so when we get the notice of awards or the agreements, we have to delineate where we fall within these categories, and that dictates how we actually approve an award moving forward. The next step we do is that once we've delineated what type of award we're dealing with, then we look at terms and conditions. And when we need terms and conditions, it basically refers to what are the regulations, what are the things that the agencies have put upon us that we need to respect, that are obligated for us to respect. It puts forth what the agency expects from us, and it also, if we don't abide by those regulations or by those terms and conditions, it puts our funding in jeopardy for that specific grant, but it also has the potential of jeopardizing other grants that we have from that agency. So clearly identifying those terms and conditions are really critical for us. We also delineate, so once we get that, the awards team is responsible for delineating those terms and conditions. And if some of them are not clear, trust me, we get a lot of awards that aren't clear. Of course, our bread and butter agencies, we're pretty familiar with that. We know what we're doing with those. But a lot of the other ones that we're getting, we get these, weird agencies, or we get grants from foundations that aren't used to these type of, the whole structure. So we get a letter that has basically no terms, so we have no idea, what exactly their expectations are. So we do have to go back to the agencies often and clarify what their expectations are. So what exactly are we looking for when we say terms and conditions, or T's and C's? Project budget period for use of funds. Again, while that might seem pretty obvious, it's not. Sometimes there is a grant agreement says, per signature date, but then there's actually another date in the agreement that stipulates that the use of funds is at this date, which is different than the signature date. Some agencies don't even provide a start date. They just say, congratulations, here you go. So we're trying to figure out, okay, what start date do we use for use of funds? But again, that is critical. Budget periods, total amount awarded and amounts awarded per year, indirect costs. We're looking to make sure that they've been assessed correctly, that they've been included. So we have to identify that to our FMS before they can open up the fund. If there's any specific eligibility or ineligible expenses, we want to highlight that, both to RFMS, but also to the PIs as well as to you. Is there something in there that is not allowed?
Is there a specific threshold travel? You can't go over 2,000, 3,000. Equipment allowed, not allowed. So we're looking to delineate a lot of those type of expenses if they're eligible or not. Rebudgeting authority, is the budget flexible between line items? Is it partial rebudgeting allowed, meaning 20%, 25%, 10%, 5%? They're all over the place. Agencies really, you know, impose what they want. So each agency is specific, so we really have to identify again, do we have full rebudgeting or not? Carry over or carry forward, carry over, all the same thing. But if you have a balance at the end of 1 year, can you carry it over into the second year or the third year? Is it allowed? Is it not allowed? Is there only a percentage that's authorized? Do we need sponsor prior approval before we allow carryover from year to year? So we really are trying to delineate those things so that everybody involved, all key stakeholders, know exactly what they're getting into when they get their award. Extensions, are they automatic? We do have some agencies that have automatic extension, 1 year extension, that PIs don't have to request it. But in general, we do have to request for extensions, and we're trying to, again, identify, is it 30 days, 60 days, 90 days prior to fund termination or project termination? Do they have a specific process? Do we have to go through an online process to submit the extension? Is it by email? Those kind of things. Reporting requirements, of course, we are very diligent in trying to identify that. What are the due dates? And if we find that due dates, especially for RFMS, if we're being asked to submit a financial report 2 days after the fund closed, it's not going to happen. Or if they have a 15-day turnaround, again, we try to negotiate that to say there is no way that our finance office can pull off a financial report in 15 days. So we're really trying to identify those things, and so that if we deem that the terms are too tight, we do try and go back and negotiate those things. And oftentimes, it's just that the agency is not aware. They, you know, they don't think about those things. So you do them a friendly reminder and say, you know, this is just not feasible for us. We're also trying to identify format of the reporting, submission. Again, are we mailing them? Are we submitting them through online submission process? Is there a specific format? Are there specific forms? For financial reporting, we often will get Excel spreadsheets that are specific that have to be complied with. Payment mechanism, how are we actually getting paid? And again, LV will go into detail about this, so I'm not going to cover it here, but there are multiple ways that we actually get paid from the agency. Mandatory in-kind matching contributions, i.e., do we have to report on this matching? Some PIs will put matching contribution in their application and say, oh yeah, sure, we'll give a million, you know, we're matching a million, but do we have to report it? And if we have to report it, then we really have to identify what are the sources of the matching, which grants are supporting this, which other existing funds are supporting this. There has to be a tangible sources that these funds are coming from. So we have to identify that at the award stage. Required collaboration sub-award agreements. Are we issuing subs? Are there any partners that will require funding from us that we need to be aware of? And unfortunately, that is an issue in that a lot of the Canadian agencies don't require that as part of the application process, we identify if there's any subs going out on those applications. So when the grant is awarded, we have no way of knowing if there's subs going out the door. We will be correcting that on the new OSR checklist, in which we will be specifically asking PIs to identify if there's any subs going to be issued that will be required. Because at that point in time, we can get the process going. If we see the checklist, when we get the award, we're able to say, oh, you need a sub issued. Let's start it. Let's get working on it. Rather than waiting, you know, a month before the budget end year and say, oh, wait, I need to send money to Laval, which happens on a regular basis because there's nothing that's triggering us to get this going. So we're going to try and correct that through the OSR checklist. And is there any related co-funding? So is a grant related to another source of funding? NSERC CRDs have industry matching requirement. So again, it's important for us to know those things so that we tell our FMS, this grant matches this. They go together. They should be considered together. We also, anything that might be quirky about the award, if the money is specific to a specific student and can't be used for any other students, there's a lot of those type of
specific terms and conditions that we, again, have to highlight at the time of the award stage. Other conditions, compliance requirements. I'm not a big fan of that. I argue that, unfortunately, we are being put as the compliance checklist police, but it is what it is. We are required by our agencies to ensure that appropriate compliance certificates are in place before we authorize release of funds. We are audited on that, so we do have to ask PIs to give us compliance certificates. And it is one of the hardest things that we do, that we are often put in a awkward position because PIs are often going to say, no, I don't need it. And you're saying, well, yes, you do. You did put on your checklist that you do. Well, yeah, but it's an existing protocol. Yeah, but it's not the same source of funding. So you need to get it amended to get the new source of funding reflected. Because we have no way of knowing if an existing protocol covers the work that's in the new grant application. We don't have the ability to assess that. So we basically go by, you get a new source, you have to update your compliance certificates, or at least contact the offices and ask them if you need to get an updated certificate. Because we're not compliance officers. We don't know the details. We don't know the regulations regarding use of humans or animals or biohazard. So we really need to get the PIs engaged in contacting those offices. We try to help as much as we can, but we do need those before we authorize release of funds. Other conditions, we do have some agencies that will want proof that the matching contribution has actually been received before they give us a final notice of award. So they'll give us a conditional notice of award, but then that condition is attached to, well, we want to make sure that the industry contribution has definitely made it. So they actually want proof that the check is in the door, that the money is in. They want us to confirm appointment. So the PI was eligible at the time of application. Is he still eligible now that the grant is awarded? Or they also want to see that we've put in place collaboration agreements. So if there's a lot of partners, we have to do MOUs or collaboration agreements before they give us the final notice of award. So those are conditions, additional conditions imposed by some of the sponsors. So once we've kind of delineated all that, what's our next step? We work with InfoEd. I know that a lot of you have access to InfoEd. For those of you who do not have access to InfoEd, please touch base with us at the end of the session, email Amy. It really is our tool, and it is something that you have access to for your org or your PIs that you have that you work with, because it is confidential information in there, so we can't open it up to everybody, everything. But it really is our working tool. It's how we actually communicate with our FMS. It's our workflow database. And a lot of the reports that are being generated to the principal, to provost, to your dean's chairs are all coming from InfoEd data. So this is kind of what the screen looks like, and it seems really benign when you just look at it to say, oh, you know, they're just entering start date, end date, and amounts awarded. But as I just explained, it's not always that easy. There's a lot of detective work sometimes involved in getting to just filling out these fields. I'll go into detail a little bit more next slides, but this data, or what I call award parameters, when we send it to RFMS, it prints out, it summarizes in what they call the RAF, the RAF-RAF, or whatever it's called, the RIF-RAF. It summarizes all this data, and that's what they use to key in their data into Banner, which creates the fund. I'll just go back. So if we get a notice of award, CIHR, NSERC, SHRC, we usually approve those up front. So if you see here, I actually have a little pointer. So if you see here, we're actually here saying OSR has approved all years. So when RFMS gets this, when they arrive, they'll open up budget year one, but then when April 1st, 2013 kicks in, they'll print these, you know, every month they're generating reports, and every month when they get the report, they'll say, okay, April 1, we have all these funds that need the second installment. OSR has already approved it. I don't need to go back to them to approve anything. We're good to go. So they're not asking, they're not waiting for us to do an action. It's already approved. And we do these
on notice of awards, pretty much. It's the only time that we can really do this. So it mostly applies to our Tri-Council agency grants. So on multi-year awards, as I just indicated, we have an approved status in which we get a notice of award that's committed for all project period. But we also do what is called conditional approvals. So instead of seeing that, I'll show you later, but each installment, so we have conditional approvals in that grant agreements, contribution agreements. We're not going to get another notice of award. We only are going to get one notice of award, or mostly applies to grant and contribution agreements. So we've signed one contribution agreement for the life of the project. So we're not going to get anything else that's going to trigger us to approve the next installments. But those payments for future installments are conditional upon submission of required reports. We are not going to get paid unless we submit those reports. So the way that we have now, what we've now established is we're now using a conditional approved status. So we're letting RFMS know, go ahead, open up the budget for year two, proceed with the installment and banner, you know, give the spending power to the PI, but we're advancing the monies to the PIs. The payment is really conditional upon us submitting our reports. And if therefore those reports are delayed or they're not being submitted, we don't get paid. We're going to be tracking that. And at that point in time, we'll make assessments to see, do we freeze? Do we adjust the budgets? What are we doing with this? We go back to the PIs and say, we're not getting paid. We have an issue. Whereas before we were waiting, keeping these in NOD received status, we weren't approving them. So instead of preventing access and spending power, we are now giving spending powers to the PIs in advance, but we are taking a bigger risk in doing that. So the intent of the RAN is really trying to get all of us involved in trying to say, you know what, we all need to be together in this and reminding PIs that reports are due, because, we're advancing money here, so we really need everybody's help to say your reports are due, this is needed in order for us to get the payments in the door. I love this little thing. So like I said, it applies to our provincial awards. Provincial awards, all our FQR grants are conditional. They are actually very stringent. They will not release payments to McGill unless all those reports are submitted. And most all grants and contribution agreements will be conditional. And the last type of approval that we do is we keep in NOD received. So I'm going to go to the next slide, just so you have an understanding of what I'm talking about. So remember the first slide. All this was approved, but as you see here, year one is approved. We have confirmation, but the other 2 years are conditional. Versus here, in this one, we have an NOD received. NOD received is that every year, RFMS cannot increase the budget without coming back to OSR and making sure that that moves into an approved status. We're waiting for something from the agency confirming that, yes, indeed, they approve the release of the next installment. NIH functions that way. We get a notice of award every single year for those. NSERC CRDs, we get a notice of award every single year for NSERC CRDs. And the majority of our sub-agreements, when we are the sub-recipients, that will apply. Because when we're the subs, we do the same thing when we issue subs. We always do it 1 year at a time. So there's some control being kept by the lead institution to make sure that the work is happening, that the collaboration is going well, so that we're not releasing funds up front for the whole project. We hold back, and then every year we get an amendment or another letter confirming, here's your next installment. So we hold back approval, and hence why it stays in NOD received status. So what could delay us from actually approving the award, which means that it delays fund opening? The big one is that we're not aware that the grant is awarded. We don't know. We will see that it goes through a new fund request, which eventually ends up in RFMS, and then RFMS says, oh, wait, this goes to OSR, so we're kind of going round in circles.
So anything that is research-related really needs to come to OSR for approval before RFMS can open up a fund. So if you get a PI that comes to you and says, oh, I'm getting $5,000 or $10,000, send it our way. Send it to awards, not to your fund administrator, not to RFMS. They won't be able to approve it and open up a fund unless it's been OSR approved first. Limited information. Again, this doesn't happen with our bread and butter agencies, but we often do get emails that say, oh, I'm going to get $5,000 here. Oh, I've been awarded this $10,000. And we're struggling to try and figure out what exactly it is. We have very little information. The emails contain very little details. We don't know where the money's coming from. We don't know the reporting requirements. We have very little details. So it requires us to do a lot of detective work. Those will take more time before we can actually approve it and release it. So in a nutshell, it goes with the grant application bypassed OSR bullet. As Olga mentioned, if an agency doesn't require a signature on the application, a lot of our researchers will assume that they don't need to come through OSR, that they can just go ahead and submit it. They can. There's nothing that physically prevents them from doing that. But if it gets awarded, we're back at square one. We start the whole thing again. We need a copy of the proposal. We need a copy of the OSR checklist. We start assessing, did the chairs, did the deans approve? It has to go through the process before we open the fund. So it does take more time. So lesson learned, if I can just, put that across, for you is, tell your PIs, please, please, please do not bypass OSR. We're not trying to be a burden, but it does help with the award process as well. Another thing, negotiation of grant agreement could delay. Having said that, we have implemented a risk assessment process in that if we see that the terms that need to be clarified will not really impact the dollar amounts that are being awarded, and we have a clear start date, we know start date for use of funds, we are going to go ahead and OSR advance approve release of funds. So it will go to RFMS, it will go through fund creation, but the grant agreement might not be yet fully negotiated. So we are trying to improve in getting access, faster access to the grant funds, to the PIs, with the understanding that we will be negotiating those terms that are not deal breakers. It's not as if we're not going to get this signed eventually. It's just going to take a little bit more time for us to clarify the terms. Compliance certificates missing, that is a big one. Again, the word to the investigators is as soon as they get a fundable score, if they get any wind of a fundable score, if they think they're going to get funded, if they get an email from the sponsor to say, hey, this is looking good, or they get an email to say, we've done the peer review, you've been selected, but now it needs to go through our internal process, as soon as they get those kind of notifications, they should start their certificate compliance process, because then we avoid delays for the fund opening. Again, other conditions required by the sponsor, as I mentioned before, matching funds need to be confirmed, MOUs need to be signed, co-funding needs to be confirmed, those kind of things. Or RFMS is missing information from us. So we thought we did it right, and it gets to RFMS, and they call us or they email us and say, oh, this isn't clear, and then we have to clarify things. So fundamentals of our award approval process. As I said, we get the NOA and the agreement, and everything is good. We get all the pertinent award information. We delineate terms and conditions. We outline those. We make sure compliance certificates are in place. We identify award parameters. As I said, start date, end date, budget periods, those kind of things. We enter all that into InfoEd, and we OSR approve it, and we... An action item is sent, so the action item is actually sent via InfoEd, and then it moves on to the RFMS team. So I'm going to hand this over to LV. Any questions? Comments? No? Okay, fantastic.
So as you can see, there's many, many steps that are diligently reviewed with controls in place before RFMS can actually open that fund for spending. I know that researchers normally think they get that award notice in their hands and where's my fund and where's my money? And as you saw, it's not that straightforward. There's lots of steps to be followed to make sure that we're in compliance with agency guidelines and what they expect from us. So we'll start with the fund creation. As soon as we do receive the OSR action item through InfoEd, our FMS can proceed to open the fund. So the FMT group receives these action items on a daily basis, and they extract the information and create a new fund profile in Banner. We also extend the spending power, so the budget, as well as deduct any overhead if applicable. At the same time, we confirm the fund number to the PI. We send an opening memo to the PI, to the financial, the FFOs, to the FSTs if there is one, and to our FAs in central RFMS. After all of the budgets have been set up, the PI has been informed, we do run a control report internally to make sure everything is in proper order. And the file is then forwarded to our financial administrators in our RFMS, who then review the file to ensure that they're familiar with all the terms and conditions that have been outlined, that they're well aware of all eligibility and compliance components of the file, and they administer it going forward. This is a good slide because it puts in perspective for all of us what the PI is up against once he finally receives his funding for his research grant. I was at a meeting yesterday where one PI said, you know, we get that award notice and where's my money and let me go spend it. But then reality sits in and he knows that he has to deal with all of these departments across campus in order to help him spend that money according to, of course, granting agency policies. So as you can see, HR, student accounts, procurement services, accounts payable, these are all the units involved in our day-to-day administration of grant administration and help us help the researcher spend that money wisely. So I'm going to go through all of these nine boxes. This is at a very high level what we do on a daily basis in award administration in our FMS. So we start with transaction approval process. So as soon as the budget is allocated, the PI knows and he's eager to start appointing students on his funds, as research assistants, so on and so forth. So the administrators at the department levels are the ones who initiate all of the transactions that are going to hit a researcher's fund. They have to process these transactions via different routes. As you all know, we have Minerva, procurement, MMP, P-card, so on and so forth. Once those transactions come through our FMS queues, the financial administrators are reviewing for compliance, eligibility, and fund availability. Once it's approved, then it goes to those different units you saw on the previous slide to complete the process of those transactions and pay out what needs to be paid out. We'll talk a little bit about the interinstitutional advances. So there are three categories. There is the tri-agency and provincial transfer agreements. Those are pretty straightforward. We receive an email from the PI because we don't know ahead of time who our partners are. They're not clearly indicated on the notices of awards when they're received by Marlene's team. So we can't be proactive and say we need to send monies to our partners ahead of time. We need to be poked by the researcher or the administrator to say we need to send so much money to our partner institution. And we do need the email from the researcher because we need to show our agencies that he or she has authorized that expense to be transferred out to our partner institution. So when we do receive an email from administrator saying transfer the money out, we do need to come back to you to say we need the PI's approval on that. It's required. So once we do get the email from the PIs and their authorization, we assess again for fund availability, and then the FMT team drafts up a letter of agreement that is sent to our partner institutions for their sign-off, so that they have to agree to those terms and conditions in the letter. Once we receive that letter back, and it's usually via email, we release the check to that institution. We inform the PI and whoever initiated at the department level so that everyone's informed that the payment has been released to that partner institution. So that's for the tri-agency. For all other agencies or ineligible tri-agency institutions, OSR negotiates those sub-award agreements with the partner institution involving the PI. So it's all done by OSR. An action item is sent to our FMS, and when we receive that action item, again, we check for fund availability, and then we don't need a letter of transfer in this case because the award agreement is the agreement, in fact, that has been signed off by all partners and the PI. And so then we just release a check, and we include a copy of that agreement with the payment. For multi-year sub-award agreements, it's the same process, although we do need to verify if there were any amendments that are required at that time before we release the payment. So we don't release it automatically. We do need to go and verify that there were no changes to the initial agreements. So now we're going to talk about those infamous adjustments. We have three types, and I'll go through all of them. So when do we transfer expenses? We've seen all of these on our day-to-day in our day-to-day activity. The first one is when a PI is parking expenses in another fund while waiting for a new fund to be established. So that should be, we've seen a decrease, I believe, in that area because we've centralized the fund opening process. The funds are being opened faster, and therefore the parking should have decreased a little bit. It also, I'm seeing no's in the crowd. I think that we have to really plan it all. It's all about planning when it comes to parking expenses where they shouldn't be incurred. Oftentimes, we know that researchers have more than one fund. Some of them have 10 funds. So their habits are to spend down in the first fund, go to the second fund, and start depleting balances that way. And then they remember, oh, this should have gone to fund number one instead of fund number two. So it's our job to help them plan at the beginning rather than at the end, because agencies do not like to see these transfers of expenses going back and forth between funds. So we should try our best to assist the PIs in planning the expenses from the get-go, and it would decrease these types of adjustments. A legitimate adjustment is when you do recognize that there's a wrong charge within a fund and that needs to be transferred out. That's fine. We can do that. Then there's ineligible expenses incurred in a fund that doesn't allow for that type of expense. That has to be transferred out. If a fund is overspent, of course, we need to remove those expenses. And when a fund is terminated and has a balance or overexpenditure, we need to clear that out as well. So those are the types of expenses. So then we also have a salary and benefits incurred at McGill, the transaction. So those are processed via a FOPOL change in Minerva. We have retro salary and benefits incurred at McGill. These are also Minerva forms. That's what you need to use to correct those types of errors. Any expenses paid to a third party, it's usually a journal that's processed moving the actual expense using the document code to reference back for audit trail purposes. We have student awards incurred on BSAS. I'm sure most of you are familiar with that. That's a reassignment request on Minerva. And then non-salary expenses, those are all journals, and we always have to reference back to the original document code. And we should never be transferring the same expense more than once. So we do see sometimes, expenses transferred from this fund to that fund. We report on that. Then that expense is transferred from this fund to another fund. We should not be doing those types of gymnastics. It's not really a best practice. We also have budget adjustments. So the types of budget adjustments are, we refer that back to a budget installment, so when we set up an automatic budget in a fund, so those are renewals. And automatic renewals are all the, affect mostly tri-agency grants, so your CIHRs, NSERC, SHRCs, CRCs, And they're all automatically renewed in April, so you'll see a mass renewal going into funds on that date only. We have the conditional renewals that Marlene spoke of before, and the NOD received, those require OSR approval, so we can only set up those budgets when we have approvals from OSR. Then we have budgets increase and decrease. Those two require OSR's approval. We can't just willy-nilly be increasing and decreasing budgets. We have to always be in compliance with agencies. And then we have budget reallocation. Some grants have specific budgets. Not all of them do. But when they do, we need to respect variances. And therefore, when the variance is over what we're allowed to juggle between budget line items, we do need agency approval there as well, and we do go through OSR for that as well. So we also have other related FOPL changes. We often get org change requests, whereby sometimes a researcher has dual appointments in two departments, or maybe he's in the Department of Biology, but his research is more intensive in another department, so they prefer that org. Those types of org request changes should be going to the FFO for their approval, and then the FFO will forward it to us. The reason for that is that if we change orgs, it affects reporting at the faculty level. So if they've seen funds appearing on their reports for whatever reports they're preparing for their faculties, all of a sudden it might drop because of an org change. It doesn't show up under their org anymore. And then questions start to be asked, why was that org changed without our knowledge? So we've put that process in place. And any change in PI must be going through the Office of OSR. PI change requests include sabbatical leaves, maternity leaves, temporary leaves. So we need to know when that happens, and you need to contact and communicate OSR so that they can then communicate with the agencies for these changes. These are very important changes. So a word about no-cost extensions. A no-cost extension is when a fund is extended but no additional monies are awarded, or the budget is not increased. It's just because there's a balance in the fund, you've reached the end of that grant, and now the researcher would like an extension. So for automatic extensions such as the tri-councils, tri-agency now, sorry, so if it's an operating grant, for example, and the tri-agency is for 3 years, we automatically extend that fund for the fourth year because they're allowed. So we in RFMS include that 1 year right away. So the date that you see for tri-agency, that is the true end date, including the 1 year automatic extension. So they have that one additional year to spend the balance down, and after that, they cannot access that balance. That's for tri-agencies, excuse me. For not automatic, it requires OSR's involvement. So if it's another agency other than the tri-agencies, and they've come to the end of their grant period, they have a balance, they would like to spend it, we freeze the fund until such time. OSR goes back to the agency with the PI. We usually have to provide a reason for that. And then if it's authorized, we extend it for that amount of time, and after that time, there is no other extension that can be requested. It's usually that's the one we report on. They either use the balance or they lose the balance. So these are just examples of no-cost extensions, and you'll see it's mostly the tri-agencies, including our provincial partner tri-agencies. So reporting. So we have three types of reporting that we do in RFMS. We have the auto-generated financial reports, and those are usually for the tri-agency. So we have a system in place that auto-generates these financial statements, although we do sometimes have to revise them, and therefore it's a manual statement. We do have many of those. It's a mass production, so it's over 3,000 statements that are produced using that statement, and those are, we're actually entering our peak period, so they're usually produced the first week of April, and submission deadline is June 30th. Then we have the sole source financial reports. And those are other funding agencies where they don't have other partners, there is no in-kind contributions. We're just reporting on that funding source and including consolidation of any ex-quoted funds. So if there was an ex-quoted fund where there's a main fund, but the researcher had a partner at McGill and wanted to share some of that funding, so we open up a separate fund, and then we still have to consolidate it, but it's still only one funding source. And then we have the multi-component financial reports. These are the most complicated ones in our area. They're all manual, so we may have preset Excel spreadsheets that are given to us by the funding agency, but we still have to manually input the information in those templates. We have to consolidate these financial reports because it usually includes in-kind contribution, cash contribution, partnership contributions. So there's a lot of components involved in these types of reports. There is forecast budgeting that we also have to keep in mind here. So it's and justification of variances. So this volume here, although it may not be as high as other statements we prepare, it's the most complex statements we prepare. So we have several reporting periods in our office. We're basically always preparing financial statements. It's our biggest activity. So we have annual, we have semi-annual, quarterly, every 18 months, and we forgot to put it here, but more and more so we've been requesting, agencies request interim statements. So they send us an email and they want an interim statement for whatever period, and we have to prepare it. So that's becoming the norm these days. The deadline to submit financial statements could be anywhere between 15 days to 90 days. The 15 days is a lot of hustling on our part. It doesn't give us a lot of time to prepare a financial statement after the month is closed. So the federal agency's granting year end is coming up. It's March 31st, which means the peak period in our office starts April to June. So we're very busy. And CFI is also included in that deadline. Other agencies have different reporting deadlines, so it can be anywhere within the year. So basically, like I said before, we're always preparing a financial statement. Whether it's one day or another, we're always in that action. And some agencies require supporting documentations to be submitted along with the financial reports. So more and more, we're seeing, and those are terms that we always go back to OSR with, where we try to negotiate that out of our conditions, is where they're asking us for copies of all supporting documentation along with the financial statements. So they want the financial statement, and they want a copy of every single transaction that went through. That's a lot of work for us. We don't have resources, as we all know, so those are conditions we're always going back to OSR with, saying, you know, you should negotiate and try to take these clauses out. However, the granting agencies are the ones with the cash, so they say, if you want the cash, you got to give us what we want. So we're trying to negotiate more and more with these funding agencies to make it a little bit easier for us. We are open to audit, so they're welcome to come and audit us anytime, although that's a ton of work as well. But we'd rather they come and audit after the fact if they need to, and not us wasting time at the beginning in preparing financial statements and running after source documents, because it's really a tedious task. So other considerations, I believe I mentioned this before, is subawardees, ex-quoted funds, matching funds, in-kind contributions. These are all components of financial reporting. And also, when it's a final financial report, we have to make sure that any outstanding encumbrances are cleared, that all unspent balances, we should be spending it down. We don't want to send any money back. And over expenditures must be clear. So how do we get paid? So most of our agencies have a payment schedule. So for example, the tri-agencies pay us every 2 months. We get a direct deposit into our bank account. We have others where they pay us only based on invoices issued out to them based on their schedules, and they send us the money. Claims is the same thing. It's for actual costs incurred and financial statements. So we, McGill University, advances the spending power to each and every researcher. So we have to make sure that we're on the ball and collecting all those commitments that are made to the university. We don't want to be out of pocket. We want to make sure we're collecting this. And therefore, we run our internal receivable aging reports to make sure that we're on the ball and sending out whatever requirements in order to get our cash in. So just a word about financial reports. All financial reports and claims must be prepared by our FMS, Central Finance. We do get some instances where we receive financial reports prepared at the departmental level. We've seen them signed at that level and forwarded to agencies, and we see that after the fact. We should not be doing that. We are the ones responsible for ensuring that the data we're reporting is in line and balances to our GL and that the transactions are eligible and in compliance. So we're the authority on that, and only our area can prepare financial reports. They are all signed by me, and in my absence, they're signed by Kristen Mouth, the controller. So we're the signing authority for these financial statements, and no one else should be signing on our behalf. And the PI is also required to review and sign all financial reports. You'll see that most times we send financial reports and we copy administrators. We need your help to get those statements back to us because we have deadlines with agencies, and if we don't meet those deadlines, it affects not only our reputation, but it affects the money coming in. So we might tap you on the shoulder to say, could you go nudge him and get him to give us our statement back so that we can send it off to the sponsor. So a word about monitoring and compliance. These are the people that behind the scenes, while the grants are running lots of checks and controls to make sure that we're complying with all the agency guidelines and regulations, because when they come in to audit us, we want to make sure that we're not going to get unsatisfactory results. So they oversee the over expenditure monitoring report. They follow up with other control reports such as aging and invoice tracking. They're the ones that measure performance and KPIs. They will eventually be simulating a tri-agency type audit so that we make sure when we get our next audit we're in good standing with them. They communicate the findings, so whatever tests they perform, meaning they test control reports, P cards, expense reports, MMP, all the transaction streams, these are the people that are testing to make sure that we're in compliance. And once they find results, they communicate it to upper administration and to the faculty so that we're correcting processes as we go along, and we're being proactive and not waiting for external parties to come into our house and tell us we're not doing a good job. So some of the examples of control reports are over expenditures, aging reports, new fund control reports, letters of guarantees, inter-institutional advances. We check that to make sure we're getting back all the financial statements for monies advanced out, ineligible expenses for tri-agencies. And then we have compliance programs. These are the ones that we're testing transaction streams. So it's P-card, expense reports, feeds, invoices, so on and so forth, just to name a few. There's more. So for auditing / monitoring visits, usually the sponsor will contact us and the PI. Excuse me, I gotta blow my nose. Sorry. Usually the sponsor will contact us and inform us that they would like to come and audit us. They don't give us any notice. They just send us an email and say we would like to come on this day. So we usually try to postpone it a little bit because we need to get all our ducks in line for this process. It's quite a task. Once we receive the request, then we have to send the auditors a list of expenses incurred on whatever fund they are auditing for whatever period. Once they receive that list, then they pull out their sample selection. So they'll send us a list back and say, these are the items we want to see when we come over. And that's when we in Central RFMS will have to pull out all source documents, and oftentimes we have to come back to the department level to get other source documents, especially for salary transactions, PCAR transactions, so on and so forth, to compile the file so that when the auditor comes in, we give them a complete file and hopefully we'll do well on that audit. RFMS is the one that coordinates the entire audit process. So we communicate with the PI and departmental staff when need be. We don't necessarily do it all the time, but if the need is there, we will contact the PI and the department staff. And some agencies, more and more so, will want to meet with the PI directly to ask them all kinds of questions vis-a-vis research support, processes, controls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So a word about supporting documentation. So for expense reports, we don't have a big problem here because we keep all the expense reports centrally. Those are the easiest documents for us to retrieve. Then we have the feeds. So there is invoice. We need the invoices, receipts. We have to see a PI's authorization and service level agreements where they exist. For feeds for payroll, we need award certifications. We need to see a Minerva appointment form, offer letters, signed memos, timesheets. All of these things are the documents that auditors look for. IDC, same thing. Journals, we need to see the invoices, the receipts, PI's authorization. The P cards is a big one because we don't do so well here because the PIs hold on to their receipts. So we usually have to be requesting a copy of the receipts that they maintain in their own offices. And student awards, same thing, awards, certification, invoices, and notices of awards. So that brings us to the award closure. So for the award closure, the project is usually complete and the PI has submitted final technical reports and all milestones have been met. All funding should have been received by the sponsor at this point in time. All interinstitutional advances should have been accounted for and received. Any unspent balances should have been sent back to McGill University. All payments to subawards and vendors should have been made by now. So everybody's been paid. We owe no monies to no one, no surprises. All outstanding encumbrances are canceled. Outstanding travel advances are reconciled, and all financial reporting and or invoices are complete, and the balance is zero. That's a perfect scenario. Does it happen this way all the time? No, it does not. So, but this is what this is a checklist of what we expect at fund closure. So what happens to unspent balances at award closeout? We have a couple of scenarios. So the first one is the unspent balance on ex-coded fund. There's an ex-coded fund and there's an unspent balance. That unspent balance makes its way back to the main fund and the ex-coded fund is closed. Scenario two is the unspent balance on the main fund is returned to the sponsor, the budget is reduced, and the fund is closed. And the third one is the unspent balance. The sponsor allows the PI an extension to spend down that balance, and once that balance is spent down, then the fund is closed. So those are the three scenarios. So a word about competitive renewals. So researcher has successfully completed his research project and would like to secure funding to support the next phase. So here the grant cycle begins. If it's a competitive renewal, this sponsor has the same award grant number. When it's a competitive renewal, because these are new terms that Marlene has introduced to our team, we usually call them renewals. So usually if it's a renewal, the sponsor keeps the same, they have reference numbers. And usually the title of the project stays the same. So if that stays the same, the fund number that was initially given to the award at the beginning of that 3-year term, let's say, would stay the same. If the sponsor changes the reference number, changes a little bit the title of the research, then it's a whole new ball game. Then a new fund is established for that new project. So in that case, a new info at PT record would be established and transmitted to RFMS, and we'd open up a new fund. So that brings us to the end of our presentation. We have a contact list for you to reference if you need help from any one of our areas. We'd like to open the floor to questions at this time, if there are any. So the reference number stays the same on competitive renewals, but the title may change. In that case, is it the same?
Yes.
We
so
wouldn't.
The question is, correct. So on competing renewals, so a competing renewal means that the PI is going back for another cycle of funding. He's recompeting. He, she is recompeting with their peers again for funding. So at that point in time, if it gets awarded with a different grant number, we are required at that point in time to open a new fund. If it keeps the same, if it keeps the same grant number, but it changes just titles, we will keep the same fund number at that time. So it's not the title that dictates, it really is the grant number, the reference number. The other thing I just wanted to also clarify from my slides is that the T's and C's, we enter them all in InfoEd. So again, for those of you who have access for InfoEd, it is there. I mean, not the old files. This is something that we have implemented over the past couple of months. But any new awards will have that information in InfoEd in terms of carryover, rebudgeting, all that stuff. So it really is a great tool for you to have access to and use. And the other thing, too, is in no-cost extensions, be aware that, as we all know, funding is getting more and more difficult. Agencies are really tight with their budgets, whereas it used to be that potentially before you would submit a no-cost extension, even after the project had turned, an agency would be relatively, loose with that. It's getting tighter and tighter. Ask for no-cost extensions in advance. Pay attention to those end dates. We do have agencies who are refusing no-cost extension, NDEIE being one. So if we ask for it after the term date, it's no go. So I'm not saying that all agencies will do that, but to be on the safe side, touch base with us as soon as you're going into 60 days, 90 days before the fund is due to term. Look to see if we get an automatic extension. If we don't and there's money left, contact us as soon as possible so that we can start processing no-cost extensions ahead of time, because some agencies will want to get more information as about what's the scope of work that remains, those kind of things. So pay attention to that, because money is getting tighter, as we all know. Anything else?
Any other questions? Yes?
That's a great question. So I will repeat the question. The question is, when PIs go on sabbatical or maternity leave or leave of absence, is OSR notified by administration? The answer is no, unfortunately. There is no process that notifies OSR. So most often than not, we find out after the fact. We find out when the PI has been gone for 6 months and we're like, oh, now we have to figure out what to do. There is no process currently in place. We are looking at that. We are trying to make connections with the provost office to say we need to be notified because this impacts research administration. We're not there yet. So in the meantime, again, we ask for assistance as soon as a PI is authorized for maternity leave, a sabbatical leave, leave of absence. Please, please, please let us know. Some agencies will not... are okay with PIs being on sabbatical, but some other agencies, provincial awards, NIH, if the PI is gone for more than 3 months off-site, They want to know. They want to know the plans for managing the research, plans for managing their labs, what's the intent, who's going to be picking up while the PI is not available, is not on site. So again, we have to assess each agency requirements as to leaves of that nature. So please contact us. Yes? I'm sorry, what?
So
if the PI has already, if in those instances, if, so the question is if the PI has already informed the agency, fantastic, but then we still need to know. We still need to know because there still might be an action item that is required in terms of, has he identified an interim PI? Has he, you know, does somebody else need access? You know, are we naming an FFM interim PI? Those kind of things. So we still need to know. And if they've already notified and they have confirmation that the agency has approved, we're going to need that as supporting documentation. Any other questions? Yes.
I'm wondering how PIs that have been, they've just been notified that they have been awarded a grant, how they know when and where to submit the ethics certificates and other compliance certificates. Are they sent an email from your office? Or...
Okay. So the question is, when a PI receives notice of award, and do they know that they need to be contacting compliance offices, and if they, and are we providing them with reminders to do so? So there's a two-step process. Exactly. So on the OSR checklist, that's why that checklist is so critical to us. We rely on that checklist. So the PIs are required to fill out if there's any certificates required. So again, at that point in time, if you're notified of a notice of award, you can go into InfoEd, look at the checklist, and you'll see right then and there if there's certificates that are required. Then we can, at that point in time, you can tell the PIs, hey, OSR is going to be looking for this. They're not going to approve unless you have these certificates in place. So the checklist is the place to go for administrators that they can look and help guide the PIs in that. If it's there, we're going to be looking for it. If we get a notice of award and we don't have certificates on file, we will be emailing the PIs and asking them for those certificates before we authorize approval of fund. So we will be contacting PIs in those instances. I mean, it's not a bad idea in that before at that point in time, they already know, because it might take time, again, where you might know before we do that an award has been granted. So if you're notified before we are and that the PI has said, hey, I have a new notice of award, or I'm going to get this $5,000 or this award, at that point in time, giving him the heads up that this is going to be required is always a good thing. The better we are at getting them to move on those compliance certificates, the better it is in terms of getting funds approved and released.
That's the question here.
Don't normally.
There is a code of conduct of research, a research code of conduct for every investigators. It is their responsibility to ensure that they're conducting research that has all required certificates. It really is of their ethical conduct. But there's also, like I said, we won't release fund opening without the certificates in place.
Yes. Yes, so we do perform eligibility checking. That's monitoring and controls that would do that behind the scenes, making sure we're in compliance. So it's testing that we do. Although, as financial administrators, we wouldn't know if they're purchasing an item, whether or not it relates to animal testing, or we don't tie it back to the certificate. So, like Marlene explained, it's a code of conduct, and the researcher is liable. He's the one that's responsible to make sure that his research is in line with the predetermined reasons and approvals and ethics certificates, so on and so forth. We're not in a position to tie back every single expense to an ethics certificate. It doesn't work that way. So it's two distinct exercises, if you will. We have controls in place to detect if something is wrong vis-a-vis controls and ethics certificates, animal certificates, humans, so on and so forth. And we have controls in place that will address expenditure eligibility. So it's two distinct exercises, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, we're assuming that when we authorize opening a fund, that means that the PI is authorized to charge expenses related to human involvement, expenses related to animal involvement, expenses related to biohazard materials. If they say requirements are needed, we've verified that they are in place at the time we authorize release of funds, then at that point in time, they are authorized to charge related expenses to their fund.
I think it's more the other way around, that if they say no, that they don't require it, that FSTs might be worried that they're putting something through that would require. So should they be telling the researcher, look, I think when you're doing interviews, even though you said no, you need to go find out, you need to get an ethics certificate.
I mean, the comment is that if the PI has indicated on the OSR checklist that he didn't need approval certificates in place, and therefore we, you know, went with it, we authorized release of funds, opening of the fund, and if the FSTs or, you know, department administrators are realizing that, hey, they're putting related human expenses on their funds, if you become aware of that, then absolutely let us know so that we can address it. Are we asking you to be that type of no. monitoring police? No, we're not. Again, at one point in time, there is a code of conduct that investigators are required to comply with. It is of their career, their reputation. There is also a protection mechanism in place that when they publish, they submit a manuscript, and if the journal editor sees that there's humans involved, they will be asking for those compliance as well. So, again, there is, you know, at one point in time, there is a roles and responsibilities. For those of you who attended our first session, we do talk about roles and responsibility. That is a role and a responsibility that falls right back to the investigator. So there's just so much that you can do to police those things. If you become aware of an issue like that, though, of course, let us know. Then we can address it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So she, you know, she was pointing out that at MUHC, I'm assuming. Okay. At an affiliated hospital, you know, they were verifying eligibility of expenses based on the certificates. We don't do that. We don't expect people to do that. And the reason for that is that if a PI gives you a reimbursement for a human subject and say this participant participated today and is owed $100, you're going to verify if they have a human subject certificate. You have no way of knowing that that subject was seen for that specific protocol. He might be enrolling for a completely different protocol for which he doesn't have that approval. There's no way that you would be able to identify if that expense is really appropriate to that protocol that's approved by the REB board versus is that that expense, that patient or that subject you know, as Vera mentioned, it could be just a new, you know, I'm just going to do an interview or a survey and doesn't have the approvals for that. You would have no way of knowing that. Again, it falls back on the ethics code of conduct of investigators, in my view.
So that's not a role and responsibility that we impose on our administrators at McGill University. They're not in a position to make those types of decisions.
No. Anything else?
Anything else?
No.
Anything else?
No. We just wanted to mention, just another last quick mention and then we'll let you go.
Hi, everyone. Just wanted to quickly say that as part of the subject covered today, we will be providing some tools, which will be up on the website probably next week. We'll send out a message to the listserv. The tools that we'll be providing will be a tutorial on subaward agreements. You'll probably notice in the session today we kind of quickly skimmed over it. The intention is in 2014 that we will have a session devoted to understanding subawards, but in the meantime, so that everyone gets a good basic understanding of them, we'll be providing a little tutorial. It's about 10 slides or so explaining how subawards work here at McGill and what process you need to be aware of for them. We'll also be providing a list of abbreviations. As you probably noticed, even though we've only done two sessions, we use a lot of acronyms, abbreviations, and sometimes you can get pretty lost. So we've created a list of the commonly used ones, the ones that we most often see in research administration, and that'll be up on the website, as well as we're working on providing some examples of the different grant mechanisms that Marlene had discussed, you know, so that you'll see a couple examples of a notice of award, what a grant agreement looks like, what a contribution agreement looks like, and those will be going up on the website as well. As you know, we have the evaluation forms, so before you leave today, please fill out the evaluation and hand it to one of us, one of the organizing committee. We really appreciate your feedback. Hopefully we will be making this into some type of online survey so that we won't have to keep printing out paper. That's something that we'll be working on probably for the next session. But in the meantime, please fill out the forms and give us your feedback. And of course, if you have any comments, feedback you'd like to see for sessions, just email through the website to the researchadministrator.osr@mcgill.ca. And I think Marlene has. Do you have something else to say?
No.
Okay. So we want to thank you all for coming today and have a nice weekend.
Thank you.